MSU Today is online at SpartanPodcast.com. Here's Russ White.
Here's Michigan State University President Luana Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis with MSU Provost Kim Wilcox.
Well, we're pleased to welcome MSU Provost Kim Wilcox, a person who grew up in the UP, has deep Michigan roots, MSU graduate, and went on to a number of very important administrative assignments as well as work as an academic. And we're pleased to recruit him back, not with as much fanfare as some of our the D'Antonio recruitment, but still someone who is making a big difference at Michigan State. Most people have no clue what a provost does. So do you have a really simple answer for that?
Well, let me tell a little story first. growing up in the UP, being a Michigan State alum, my mother was more than excited to hear I was coming back to Michigan and going to work at Michigan State University. She was telling all her friends, and I was still living in Kansas at the time, and one day on the phone she said, "Kim, people are really excited. I'm really excited you're coming home, but they all ask me, what's a provost?" So if you go to the MSU provost website, there's actually a little phrase there, a little place to click on, what's a provost? It's there for my mother.
I actually looked it up beforehand. You know, and as a student, I didn't know if I should be afraid or give reverence to the
Or both.
The simplest definition of provost is chief academic officer. So the person who's in charge of all the academic activity on the campus, that's all the students, all the professors, all the teaching, all the research is my purview.
I think one of the things as an athletic director, we have 25 sports, so you kind of have to, you know, be in tune with everything. And it's very much on a much bigger scale, which you do with academic programs, in that you have your you know, your wrestling, gymnastics programs, and you also have your football, basketball programs that you have to manage through from a personnel, budget, and curriculum standpoint.
See, I thought it was easier. You've got 25 sports. I've only got 16 colleges.
Oh, heck.
Yeah, but you're right. It's everything from literally brain surgeons to poets and engineers to chemists. It really is the breadth of Michigan State University, and that it's a challenge, but more importantly, it's the invigorating part of the job. The kinds of people that I get to meet and see and work with every day is really a treasure few people get the chance to have.
It's difficult to be a master to all the activities that you have to oversee.
So no, don't say that on the radio.
So when you're making your decisions or when you're going through trying to come up with programming, who do you reach out to? Who do you lean on as far as that decision-making process? Are the people on campus, off campus, or a combination of both?
The simple answer quickly to that is both, and let me go on a little bit about it. But there's another part to the question I want to come back to as well. In terms of support people, I'm fortunate to have a president who spent many years as provost at Michigan State University, so I've got right-hand knowledge whenever I need it. And, of course, the university over many years has developed an internal structure and an internal set of knowledge and traditions that support that. So there are associate provosts who instruct me in undergraduate education, graduate education, and so forth. The deans who lead the colleges are good resources. While they're advocating for their own areas, they also understand how their pieces fit into the larger pool. And then, of course, off campus, we have alums, many of whom have gone on to very prestigious and important careers in their own fields and can reflect back on what Michigan State did for them in preparing them for their roles now, as well as other groups around the state, interested parties, people with engineers, for instance, who can help advise on the direction of the engineering program and so forth. But the other part, and the other comment I'd make is, there are some truths, some common truths. And yes, it certainly helps to be an expert in nuclear physics if you're talking to the physicists, or an expert in medicine if you're talking to the physicians. But at the same time, in most cases, people can make a pretty good case or explain what's important to them and to their program. And it doesn't take expert knowledge oftentimes to kind of sort through that.
Mm-hmm. Kim, as you think about being a student in Holmes Hall, a distinguished student.
Yeah, exactly.
Much like...
just like Dr. Hall was here.
Yeah, right. Distinguished students. And it was a period of time before you came back to Michigan State. What struck you as the biggest difference in terms of the institution?
And for listeners, that was about a 30-year span. So it was a sizable piece. I guess the differences don't stack up compared to the similarities. The things that stayed true across the time were much more important. This is a place we talk a lot about how students matter at Michigan State. That's true. But I think more importantly, people matter at Michigan State. And that was true when I was a student here in the 1970s. It's true today. I was here in the mid-70s. There was just after the big building boom in the 60s, but there was much more to do. The campus has changed physically. We have more sophisticated spaces both for students and for faculty, much of that around electronics and the rest that has shaped the place. The other thing that struck me, though, is coming back as someone who spent his whole career in higher education was how little I knew about the university, even though I had been a student here. And understood universities as I came back. Most of what happens at a university is not what students experience. It's like being a kindergartner. You really don't understand how great schools work. The same is true at a university of this size and complexity. So reflecting on the university as an administrator and then thinking about how I saw it as a student was really a great opportunity.
I came in as from a small town. You and Tom are from the UP, but I only had one stop late in my little hometown too. So I came to Michigan State, and that was one of the things that kind of caught me, was almost in a position of afraid to reaching outside my comfort zone boundaries to really absorb what Michigan State had to offer. And I find it interesting now watching my son, who will start as a freshman next year, where he's very comfortable with Michigan State, and he's been around, he's been close, so he kind of knows, where to go. And I see a lot more, ambition, where I saw more, I don't know if it's fear
caution.
When I came in, it's interesting to watch different students, because I really believe Michigan State has a lot of small town feel to it, but has all the benefits of a big city. If that makes sense.
I think it makes perfect sense. And there's, of course, a couple key aspects of that. One is people talk about the beauty of our campus, but the fact that it is a well-defined campus lets people understand it in a physical sense earlier than some other places. The fact that we expect all of our freshmen to live on campus means that in the first semester, for many students in the first 3 or 4 weeks, you develop a network of friends. People who just out of the draw of the hat are living in the same room or living in the same vicinity, and that lets you start to build a network. We're being quite deliberate and strategic about that opportunity. More than we have the last 30, 40 years we've done that, but we're increasingly focused on how students integrate into the system in the first few months. We're actually starting before they even come to campus, connecting them electronically through Facebook and other means to come here and then have a network and make use of their network of friends, but also the network of staff members here, so that we can get them through the first year. Mm-hmm. If you can get oriented to the campus and the people and the programs in the first few months, then you're going to be successful most of the time.
We were going through all the checklists with TR on his application here, and I found it interesting when we had to fill out the form for season football tickets. That's a different experience.
Did he check the box?
He checked the box.
So he's going to be sitting over in the student section?
So he'll be entering with the rest of the students next fall. It'll be exciting. Right.
Mark used the sort of small town, big city analogy, but you may want to take it one step farther to the neighborhood, and that's a concept that you've been working on for quite a while.
Exactly. We are a city. On a typical day in the fall, we've got 60,000 people on campus, students and faculty and staff and visitors, and we have all the infrastructure of a big city. And like a big city, there are different neighborhoods on our campus. And we recognize that, and we've kind of built around those pieces, but we haven't been as deliberate as we might have been. So beginning 2 years ago now, we've started to think about particularly the student living areas as neighborhoods, an east neighborhood on the east side of campus, a south, and so forth. And just like neighborhoods and cities, in my neighborhood that I live, we have a school, and we have a drugstore, and we have a grocery store. We don't have a doctor's office. You have to go to another neighborhood for that, but there are some things there. And just like my neighborhood at home, different types of people have chosen to live there for different reasons. Some have been there a long time. Some are new to the neighborhood. We're thinking of the campus in the same way. And once you think about areas of the campus that have a personality and attract students with different kinds of interests, we're not requiring, but just to the extent to which people are interested, then we can start to provide services that match that. If we have a group of type of students here, then we can prepare for them the summer before they arrive. We can have the right kind of people in place to help them acclimate. And so it's not just you're comfortable in your room with your roommate or on your floor with your floor mates or in your residence hall. You're comfortable in your neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And you have a set of connections there that are even deeper and broader and help us as faculty and staff start to think about how we organize ourselves. It's a great kind of exciting time for us at the university.
And the experiment occurred in Hubbard Hall last year, very successful in my most quantitative measures. And I think from a feeling perspective, the students who started in Hubbard didn't know what a neighborhood was, and left feeling like they had a set of connection points. Now Brody's going to open in the fall in a grand scale.
Brody Hall, for many of our listeners who are alums at Michigan State University, they remember the days when Brody was the last choice for residence halls. I can report that last year we had students who chose to leave other places on campus and move into a triple room in the Brody complex because Brody is now the place to live. The food service is impeccable. We finished that last year. This year we are completing what we're calling the Engagement Center. It's a center that each neighborhood will have when we're done. That is a place for engagement by students and by staff in equal amounts at the right times. And it's not so much what you bring to the environment as what you engage within the environment. So we have academic advisors, health experts, support personnel of all types there to help students in a very exciting new space. So if you get a chance to come to campus, I recommend everybody go to Brody Hall this fall and see what's there.
And even from a recreational standpoint, those services are located at all these neighborhoods. So rather than have a location where it's a long destination to get to it, it's readily accessible. They basically go downstairs, eat, study, work out, and get medical treatment, same location.
The other part is academic services because some students come from backgrounds that are not as strong as others. Their schools, particularly in science and math, were simply not as strong as some of the more elite schools in the state. And so you've added into this mix math services as well to make sure that everybody has a chance to succeed at the highest level.
Exactly. Just like my neighborhood, I've got some things in my neighborhood and I have to go to other neighborhoods for some others. For our students, there are some things we think are important in every neighborhood. And academic success is certainly part of that. So we now have our math department providing tutors and support people in the neighborhoods. So last year in Hubbard Hall, there's about 1,000 students in Hubbard Hall. We had over half of them in one evening down in the Engagement Center working on math. And this isn't just students who are in remedial math programs. These are students in calculus and advanced math because everybody can use some help at various times in mathematics. And so we're infusing the academics into the neighborhoods so that it isn't just about having fun or just about finding friends, but it's also about academic success. Because at the end of the day, the thing that tends to make our students happiest is passing classes, passing tests, and graduating.
Makes athletic directors happy, too.
You're tuned to AM 870 WKAR. MSU Today is the program. Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis and Michigan State University President Luanna Simon are talking with MSU Provost Kim Wilcox.
Stay with this concept just a little bit longer. Hubbard was a trial. Brody is sort of the rollout of the entire concept, but the plans are to have more and more of these neighborhoods unfold over time.
Exactly. We're changing physical spaces at the same time we're changing staffing patterns. So the physical space gives us a platform, essentially. And we had some renovations to do in Hubbard Hall, which gave us that opportunity. Now Brody. Next will be South Campus. Case Hall and Wonders Wilson are spaces that we're looking at. For people who have been around campus a bit, they know that Snyder Phillips has a new cafeteria. Mm-hmm. That will be the next place we go to rethink the engagement, and that's a little bit different spatial arrangement than in the residence halls we built in the 60s. But it's something that will be kind of step by step, and at each point we learned a lot in our kind of prototype in Hubbard last year that we're going to play it on a bigger scale in Brody. And by the time we're done, we should have new physical spaces across the campus for our students and a whole new way of engaging students and staff.
So it's not simply for alums to come back and see Brody, but if I'm a student who lived in Brody last year and I decided to move off campus with some of my friends at fraternity or whatever I might do, Brody is still my neighborhood under this kind.
Correct. Traditionally, most universities like Michigan State have had a center for academic advising, a center for writing, a center for counseling, a center for. And the assumption was if you needed support, you'd go to that place, wherever you were on the campus. And that means that, first of all, students have to know what all these different centers are. They have to know where they are. Their hours have to align with what your hours are as a free in your schedule as a student. By distributing that set of resources across the campus and you becoming familiar with somebody who happened to work in your residence hall in academic advising, yes, the expectation is that you'll have a connection that you can come back to year after year after year.
And have great food.
And have great food in the in the balance, exactly.
I think one of Coach Izzo's lines that he and I used to talk about a long time ago is we continuously get older as administrators or coaches, and the people that we work for are always staying the same as far as age. I think what we're doing here with the neighborhoods is very responsive to that type. When you go to the academic side, are there curriculum decisions that you're making that are ever-changing because of the way the world changes, whether it be technology, the way people communicate? How do you approach a global and ever-changing world from a curriculum standpoint?
Yeah, when I talk with people, I'm asked that question, I first ask people to stop for a minute and think about universities in the 1920s and 1930s and what that curriculum looked like and how inappropriate would have been for them if they went to school in the 70s, 80s, 90s. So somewhere things had to change. Mm-hmm. And what happens in university is the change generally happens incrementally, a little at a time, you don't notice it. There certainly are two big domains of change that are important for us as a university. The first is that surrounds technology. Everyone has a cell phone, everyone has a laptop computer, everyone is wired in. The campus is largely wireless, so you can do things online anywhere, indoors or outdoors. That provides, in some people's minds, a distraction, but for us, it really provides another avenue. We don't have to hand you a physical book, and then if things change during the semester, sorry, the book's already printed. Mm-hmm. We can hand you a link to a site on the web, and as things change in the world of biology, that website's going to be changing as well. So it's another tool. The second piece is one that has more content related. Right now we're in a world where we read the paper, and the nation is worried about the future of our entrepreneurial culture, whether or not we're going to be creating people with the aspirations and the creativity to start new endeavors. Because simply going to work at big corporations, as we did in the 1950s and 60s, isn't going to work in the future. So simply teaching rote information and knowledge in a way that people can take it and apply it isn't enough. We need to help them understand how to create knowledge, how to create new opportunities. So we have both our College of Communication Arts and Sciences and our College of Arts and Letters talking about creativity mm-hmm. as something that we're trying to help students achieve as opposed to just knowledge of history or facts.
What role does study abroad, do you think, play in that whole dynamic of future?
Great question. It plays in two or three ways. One, I use the term engagement center. We use the term engagement a lot, and by that, in this context, it means sitting in a class taking notes. You can be pretty disengaged. the person's talking, or you can get your notes from somebody else. You can be that disengaged. A real engaged student is someone who is involved in the process itself and shapes the process. There's probably no better example than that than study abroad, where you actually have to physically move yourself mm-hmm. and do things in a world, in a language, in a culture, in a climate that's unlike what you're up to today. And by extension, learn to be creative, whether it's socially creative in a new situation around the dinner table or intellectually creative in a classroom.
That goes along with two other things that I know that collectively we've been working on very hard. One is increasing the number of students in research, typical research assignments, and also students who are in community engagement. Do you want to comment on those as well as this sort of knowledge application?
Yeah. you know, President Simon, universities are not places that teach. Universities are places that create and disseminate knowledge. And disseminate knowledge, certainly that's through instruction and that's through the library, lots of places. But you can't disseminate knowledge unless you create it. And a place like Michigan State University, we have an expectation to create the new knowledge for the next generation, the next century. If we're going to have creative students who are engaged in the future, our best opportunity for them is to get them into research. So here we don't think of research and teaching as separate things. We think of them as the same thing. You can walk through any faculty member's laboratory on campus, and you'll see more students than faculty members because it's usually one professor and three or four graduate students and six or eight undergraduate students. That's part of their learning. You learn pretty quickly when you run an experiment if you don't understand the underlying facts, and you run pretty quickly to the web or to the book to get those facts. Service learning or engagement in the community, in my mind, is just an extension of that. The things that we do to help communities are built upon the knowledge that we've created in the laboratory and in the libraries on the campus. And it's now our opportunity or our responsibility to make that information usable and useful to the community. So having students leave their classroom, leave their dormitory, go to a community center, help students or help the community grow is part of this engagement notion.
I think one of the things that is hard, I think, for folks in general to understand is that most universities have a course labeled economics or public relations, or the labels are all the same. And I think we work very hard with our external constituency to keep those refreshed and updated in terms of course labels and those kinds of things. But it really is what happens underneath that label that is the quality of education and the defining difference. And I think that's one of the things that sets apart great universities is that the priceless experiences that go within a rubric that's common to many places.
Even when I was a student, the rule of thumb was 3 hours outside of classroom for 1 hour inside the classroom. But I don't think we did a very good job of helping students with those other 3 hours. We didn't oftentimes make it appealing. I'll say for myself as a student, I wasn't always eager to spend the other 3 hours. And the support systems weren't always there for me. The ways for me to engage were basically the textbook and my notes. And I could spend 3 hours with those, but it got kind of boring. Having a one-hour class and then 3 hours of work in the community or 3 hours of work in somebody's laboratory, that's better supported because there are people around me, and it's pretty motivating for me as a student.
I think, you know, Michigan State, if I could paraphrase a little bit, we're creating an environment not to teach but an environment to learn. And as we do that, we've reached out in many ways. Study abroad, the College of Human Medicine with the Grand Rapids reaching out. But we've also brought the world to Michigan State over the years. The Wharton Center was a great example. The Eli Broad Art Museum is another example of bringing the world to Michigan State to give kids that three-hour window of maybe exploring and opening up the minds to other things that are out there that a little guy coming in from Lexington, Michigan maybe didn't have exposure to. All of a sudden, it's a step into the world in a new direction, and I applaud both of you for a project like that.
Yeah, the president gets the credit for much of this, but it is part of important to remember these aren't individual projects. These are a concerted attempt to make the breadth of the university stronger. And we recognize that we have to be strong in the sciences, but also in the arts and cultures. And it's for our students who come here. Mm-hmm. This shouldn't be a large high school. This should be a university. But it's also important to be an attraction to bring other people here, mm-hmm. to bring the community into the university as well as the university out to the rest of the society.
Look, so the tough question of the day.
Uh-oh.
The tough question of the day is that people external to the university often see sort of athletics and academics as sort of always at loggerheads. You have some responsibility for student athlete support as a part of your portfolio, but I've seen you cheer at football games and agonize with the rest of us or at basketball.
But I never boo
over the outcome of the game. As the sort of the chief academic officer representing the academics, how do you talk about the role of inclusive athletics?
I oftentimes, I think Mark's heard me, when I speak to a room full of boosters, who, of course, I'm the pointy-headed professor coming to the athletics event, I'll say I do appreciate the importance of athletics. And the best example I can think of is SUNY Stony Brook, one of our cheapest competitors. And they all look at me like I really am a pointy-headed professor. What if we compete with them? We compete directly with them in the academic domain. They're one of the leading universities in the country, leading state university in the country, particularly in physics, where we are strong, so are they. Most people have never heard of SUNY Stony Brook because they don't play Division I football or basketball. So I appreciate what that visibility means for Michigan State University, for me, and all the academics that are here. So that's one important role. Another important role is athletics do serve to unify us. You only have to go to Spartan Stadium and see 75,000 people all stand at the same time and cheer at the same time to appreciate what that is in terms of a unifying force and one that can motivate the whole campus. But at the end of the day, we're not a sports franchise. We're a university. And at the end of the day, our primary business is creating and disseminating knowledge. So we have to always make sure that the positive aspects of visibility and unifying the campus and motivating us to do things together are part of this bigger context. And I can give Mark great credit. He's been continually reaching out to the academic enterprise, not just to make sure we're in sync, but also to support us and move us ahead in the right ways.
I also think it plays a role. If you look at both students that are attending Michigan State presently and those that have before, and you take the arts, and I go back to the art museum, to the Wharton Center, it creates part of a culture that really helps transition a young person into the world. It exposes, you know, high-end athletes that are also seeking their education at the same time, along with an opportunity to see the arts. And sometimes you see the two crossover lines, which is a great sight to see. And you know, we very much appreciate being part of the university, but understand what our role is in the bigger picture.
It's interesting. You know, it's easy for us to talk about somebody from a small town who might not otherwise get to go to an art museum. But there's also an awful lot of small town children who might never otherwise get to go to a major league sports event.
Mm-hmm.
And that also is something that will broaden their view of the world forever.
I mean, I can speak for myself. Growing up, my exposure to an art museum was the local library and looking at pictures. And likewise, my dad brought me here to one or two college games as a high school student, and those are vivid memories that I have, and I think sometimes get taken for granted by people that are too close to the program.
Well, we really appreciate you being with us.
My pleasure.
Have your mother click in to hear your explanation.
I still don't know what a provost is, but
that's a secret best kept.
Right, so we'll have her click into the program, and so that we'll get at least a couple more podcast pieces. But thank you very much.
That was MSU Provost Kim Wilcox talking with Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis and Michigan State University President Luanna Simon here on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear the conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com.
MSU, we love thy shadows.
Our mission is to be your personal network for life.
Scott Westerman leads the Michigan State University Alumni Association.
Sing our love for our alma mater.
So what that means is when you graduate from college, we'll help you find your first career. When you move to any city, anywhere, we'll help you connect and settle. If you're mid-career and want to reinvent yourself, we'll help you find a new passion. And if you need advice or a friend anywhere in the world, the MSU Alumni Association will connect you with the 500,000 Spartans out there that are always ready to take your call.
Join the Michigan State University Alumni Association online at alumni.msu.edu. Alumni.msu.edu.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
The University Research Corridor, empowering Michigan.
This is an association of the three research universities in Michigan to really collaborate on a deeper level than we have in the past and highlight for ourselves and for the region and for the nation the strength in technology, innovation, new research, investment that we think is going to help change the Michigan economy.
That's University of Michigan President Mary Sue Coleman.
The mission of the URC is no less than to help transform the Michigan economy and to make this a vibrant place that young people will want to come and stay, that businesses will want to be in, because we are a place where a lot is happening, and we have the brain power for the new economy. It's here. It's in Michigan. We just need to tap it.
Visit us online at urcmich.org.
So Michigan is vibrant. Michigan has all these things, and we want to signal that to the entire world.
Visit the University Research Corridor online at urcmich.org.
Near or far, famous or known only to family and friends, one thing is clear. Every day, Spartans contribute to the common good in ways both big and small and are making a difference around the world. And they carry with them the spirit of Michigan State, proving again and again that Spartans will. And they all have a story, a Spartan saga.
As a physician and scientist, Andrea Amalfitano knows that although cures may not exist for the illnesses he sees, all hope is not lost. I'm Jim Peck, and this is a Spartan Saga.
Hope plays an important role, and in fact, it's one that consumes me.
Already?
I hope so.
I'm a physician and I'm a scientist, so I combine the two. I teach medical students, graduate students, undergraduate students. I diagnose all kinds of genetic disorders. That's what I do.
Amalfitano received bachelor's and doctoral degrees in microbiology and a doctorate in osteopathic medicine from Michigan State. He is an explorer in medicine.
I see the rarest of the rare things. Many times being diagnosed with something rare is not good news. Many times it means very bad outcomes, unfortunately. And so I spend a lot of time trying to explain that to families, understand what they're dealing with, and best to my ability, give them prognosis information as well as many things we can do. It may not be a direct cure, but many times we can support and make things easier.
Amalfitano splits his time between his clinic, where he sees patients, and his lab, where he develops gene transfer technologies that are used not only to treat genetic diseases, but also to attack other diseases, from malaria to colon cancer to HIV/AIDS. But his most significant breakthrough is in Pompe disease.
Pompe disease is a genetic disorder of, it turns out, not only the heart muscle, but also limb muscles, the muscles of your arms and legs, as well as the muscles that control your breathing. If you happen to have the form of disease where it's showing up very early, within a couple months of birth, you are very much at a higher risk of dying from that disorder because the severity is such that it affects your muscles that much more rapidly, it affects your heart that much more rapidly. And the typical lifespan up until a few years ago, you wouldn't live past the age of 2. I had the opportunity to participate in a clinical trial in which we first attempted a treatment for this disorder in the United States. And subsequent to that, based upon a number of studies both in the United States and internationally, a drug was derived exactly from the drug we had initially studied, and that's now available to all Pompe patients worldwide. And so now in my clinic, I have the opportunity to see these patients. They still turn up. They're still being diagnosed. But now I can prescribe something for which a few years ago there was nothing. Within a year or two, we find dramatic, not only stalling of the disease process, but actually reversal. And now these children are coming in and seeing me, and they're able to hop about the room, hop up on the bed to see me, and they're actually happy to see the doctor. And that's very fulfilling for me to see that, in fact, we can do that kind of a dramatic impact on these cases.
He says spending time with patients is critical to understanding the intricacies of an illness.
If I was strictly in the laboratory, I personally just think I would not have a clue about many of the conditions or the diseases that I'm attempting to treat right now based on our research. Being in contact with patients at a bare minimum is just sobering, you know, to see what families go through when they're affected with a certain disorder really just humbles you. It also humbles you in how much we don't know about many diseases. Certainly there's a lot we do know, but I am constantly learning new things from my patients. And the day you think you know everything is the day you should probably not be a doctor, because there's just too much out there that still we don't know, and patients teach me a lot. Every time I finally get in and talk with a patient, a patient's family one-on-one, it just reaffirms for me why I'm there and why I've chosen this field. And I recommend that to any of the medical students that are thinking about coming to medical school, that it truly is a fulfilling career choice.
For more Spartan Sagas, head to spartansagas.msu.edu. I'm Jim Pack.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you're instantly connected to a 500,000 Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance, and joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's great to welcome back to the program Dr. Clay Voorhees, who is an assistant professor of marketing in the Broad College of Business at Michigan State University. Clay has for several years been working with Deloitte surveying consumer attitudes on hybrid vehicles, and year number four results have been out recently. The findings are quite interesting. Clay, nice to have you back on the program.
It's great to be here.
First, a little background on these 4 years of work that you've been doing with Deloitte to sort of frame our conversation.
Okay, so starting 4 years ago, we began to partner with Deloitte in doing a nationwide data collection looking at Gen Y, who are individuals born between about 1979 and 1994 as this next big auto-buying generation. And each year we have different themes that we step in to try to identify new concerns. So we did a 2009 data collection. We looked at a lot of new powertrains to see how attitudes were shaping up. And then we took a deep dive on that topic again this last year to see how things had evolved. And we noticed some interesting changes this year over the past few years.
And what were some of the more interesting changes you've discovered?
Probably number one is this was the first year where preference for the next powertrain in the vehicle was hybrids. So it replaced internal combustion engines as far as the preferred powertrain. Doesn't necessarily mean what somebody's going to buy, but attitudinally, the typical Gen Y consumers would ideally love to be in a hybrid vehicle.
And not necessarily what they want to buy, because you have to consider a lot of things like price points and things of that nature, right?
Yeah.
Just before we get into some of the new stuff, is price still a major factor in buying behavior?
Yeah, still the number one, especially for getting into a lot of the eco-friendly technologies. It was the number one barrier that popped in the survey again. The big challenge is even on the hybrid side, it's about on average a $3,300 premium to get into a hybrid model. And because internal combustion engines are getting so much better as far as fuel efficiency, the break-even time to get your money back on a hybrid's a little over 8 years or 100,000 miles right now. So Gen Y consumers are pretty savvy, and they do their homework and do their research. And while they want to do the right thing, budgets are tight, and they don't plan on owning their cars for 8 years. So if they're going to – they're basically going to be doing self-sacrifice if they go and buy a hybrid right now, because it's not going to pay for itself.
Did you get into the difference between attitudes towards buying versus leasing, for example?
We didn't take that next step down. The biggest thing that we noticed is a lot of the buyers said they wanted to buy, but buy used. And because right now I believe hybrids and electrics only make up about 2-3% of total sales, period, there's not a lot in the pre-owned market to begin with. So if a consumer is already set on going pre-owned, that almost necessarily takes hybrids and electrics and extended range electrics out of the picture immediately.
Because there just isn't that big a pool.
And so that economic motivation right now is still trumping everything else, but we're approaching a little bit more of a tipping point as these technologies get better.
Do you get a sense from the data that these folks are still fairly young and early in their careers that they might buy the internal combustion efficiency now, but as they get more affluent and the car and the technologies change, they may be more inclined to the hybrids as maybe a second or third vehicle?
Yeah, and we actually, we always ask a forecasting question that we're just said, you know, 5 years from now, do you plan to be in the same brand and what type of powertrain would you want to be in? And there was a number of buyers there that were in brands that typically don't have many alternative powertrains yet. So a lot of the Chrysler brands, and at the time when we did the survey, Volkswagen hadn't quite announced their hybrid introductions yet, and they still wanted to be in those brands because they love those cars. But they also expected to be an alternative powertrain in 5 years for their next purchase. So for some of these brands that don't have that full suite of powertrain options, that they should get into the game pretty quick or they might lose some of these loyal buyers.
My guest is Clay Voorhees, who's an assistant professor of marketing at Michigan State University in the Broad College of Business. Clay, another thing that you looked at was some of the technology in these cars. I own a Chevy Volt, which I'm very fond of telling listeners, but the push-button technology is amazing. Does this appeal to these Gen Yers as well?
Yeah, so it was a really dominant feature is they basically expect it now. So it's not even a value add. It's table stakes to have the, at the minimum, iPod or smartphone hookups and Bluetooth, and then just having an interface. And the main motivation we found is it's really just a need for connectivity, where they don't, right now they feel like if they drive in a traditional vehicle, it's lost and wasted time, where they lose touch from reality and they're not productive. And that frustrates them. So in the survey, a lot of Gen Yers would prefer not to drive at all if they had a good alternative option. So that fun of driving seems to be gone. And so they want the technology to make that driving experience more enjoyable, one, but most importantly, really a means to stay connected with vast social networks and then professional life after that, too.
It was interesting. We just talked to a senior Ford environmental engineer and about the future of vehicles, and she was actually talking about driverless cars down the trail, which kind of dovetails with what you were just talking about.
Yeah, the interesting, what I thought was the coolest finding on these features that we asked them about, the two areas where Gen Y over-indexed relative to the older generations was technology, which wasn't terribly surprising. But after that, safety controls. So crash detection awareness and advanced engineering for safety. And so it almost appears like they know they're going to be distracted playing with their new toys. So they're willing to pay for the car to become safer to protect them from themselves as they go through. So it was interesting paradox that all of these manufacturers have to navigate now, because the Highway Safety Board, if they had their way, you'd actually have to tape your cell phone to the roof of your vehicle when you got in and not
it
until you got back out again.
In the old days, how a car, the drive, the ride, the comfort, all were important. How about the Gen Yers? Is that a big deal for them?
No, ride and comfort was about one of the lowest features rated, even for luxury buyers in Gen Y. When we looked at baby boomers, which are typically 1946 to 1964 birth rate ranges, that was one of the top features for luxury vehicles. But Gen Y, when it comes to the actual performance of the vehicle, it's really horsepower is the only, and really performance is secondary for them across the board. But when they do start to look at it, it's more of make it fun to drive, not necessarily comfortable to drive.
From your perspective, there are a whole different array of vehicles that are coming out from the different manufacturers that represent quite a portfolio of choices for the consumer. Is that in direct response to Gen Y, or is there a larger demographic at play here?
Gen Y is leading the charge, but there's definitely a larger demographic. We even noticed, I would bet, in the survey these last couple of years, we've actually tracked Gen X and baby boomers, so two older generations as well. And those generations are really peaking towards new technologies as well. And I would, if we follow the same trends, next year's survey, we might see both Gen X and boomers also having a preferred technology being a hybrid vehicle other than internal combustion engine. So times are changing pretty hard, and I think people have got comfortable with the technology now of hybrids at least, where it's a pretty much worry-free technology. So that barrier's gone. So as prices continue to fall, I think there'll be quite a few, regardless of generation, getting into those vehicles.
Well, let me take you just for this last question a little bit beyond the survey. As you put your visionary hat on and you look out there 10 years from now, what are our highways going to look like?
I think we're actually going to look pretty similar to what's out there now, but under the hood is going to be a different world where we'll have, I think the future, if we go out to 2025, where the fuel efficiency requirements are unbelievable for EPA set down. I think it's 52.5 miles per gallon that the fleet has to meet. So I think the cars are going to look the same because that's what consumers want, but the manufacturers have a lot of electric engines, and I think extended range electric is really what's going to dominate the landscape if we fast forward that 20 years, unless something, hopefully something cooler and more innovative comes out. But if not, I think extended range electric is going to be the wave of the future.
Well, by 2025, I know you'll be around, and I'm hoping that as a boomer, I'll be around to see all of this as well. Clay, it's always a pleasure. I've been talking with Dr. Clay Voorhees. He's an assistant professor of marketing at Michigan State University. I've been doing surveys of Generation X, Y, and boomers on their attitudes and beliefs on vehicles. Thanks so much for being on Greening of the Great Lakes.
Thank you very much.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com. You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Near or far, famous or known only to family and friends, one thing is clear. Every day, Spartans contribute to the common good in ways both big and small and are making a difference around the world. And they carry with them the spirit of Michigan State, proving again and again that Spartans will. And they all have a story, a Spartan saga.
I was given a grant by the Circumnavigators Club, which is an organization, an international organization, that's devoted to global unity. The members pick one or a handful of university students each year to go around the world and study some sort of global topic with the goal to promote global unity. And so my proposal was to study marine debris and get a global view on ocean pollution and its impacts and where it is in the world and how the governments and other organizations are handling it. So what I did is I independently planned and executed a 3-month around the world trip where I visited 7 different countries. I was in Hawaii, Australia, the Maldives, South Africa, England, Wales, and Iceland. At each of these locations, I was cleaning beaches, but also speaking to locals, local experts, local residents about the issue and how it impacted their environment, their socioeconomic impacts.
As a student, Kleber took advantage of this opportunity to see the world, really see it, through what we throw away.
Primarily, when I first started, my goal was to get an idea of the volume, composition, source, and impacts of marine debris at each location that I went to. And as I started traveling, it really turned more into a social issue, surprisingly enough. And I was really looking into how the people at each location were affected, and the cultures, and the economy, along with the environment. By the end of the summer, I picked up 72,000 pieces of trash. That sounds like a high number, but it really does not put a dent at all into the world's ocean pollution problem, and I understand that. And that wasn't necessarily my goal. I had a few goals in mind. One was to kind of understand where the trash was coming from and just to get kind of a global view, because there had been very few studies globally on marine debris. So I think I was one of the first in that sense, and I think it's important that we, since all of our oceans are interconnected, it's really important that we get a global view on it so we can see where these items are coming from and maybe hit it at the source. And then also, ultimately, my goal was to just raise global awareness. And I really think I successfully did that at each of the locations I went to. I was very active within communities. In various countries, I pulled together school groups to help me clean the beach. I joined local community groups that were cleaning the beach. I talked to lots of local residents, so I really just got out there and spread the word on the issue. People don't understand what happens when they throw something in the ocean. I spoke with a lot of people in the fishing industry while I was traveling, and they all said the same thing, that it's just, they're just tossing it into an abyss. They don't realize how connected everything is, that they say an item thrown overboard in Japan can make it around the world in 6 years.
She knows she's gotten to do some amazing things already. She hopes she can be inspirational.
I've been a very fortunate person. I've had so many opportunities and so many experiences at such a young age that I would love if someone would look at that and want to be that, just because I think it's important that people get out and see the world and do these things and be proactive. So if I can pass that on to someone, that would be wonderful. Two biggest things is take opportunities as they come and take risks. You gotta do both of those things. You can't just let opportunities go, because they're not going to come back. You got to jump on them and take risks. Nothing out of the ordinary is easy, but it's almost always worth it.
For more Spartan Sagas, head to spartansagas.msu.edu. I'm Jim Peck.
You're listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the Michigan State University Alumni Association. And if you're the parent of a Spartan, there's no better gift you can give than a lifetime membership in the largest Spartan organization in the world. Joining the MSUAA family opens the doors to our network of over 500,000 Spartans who'll help you feel right at home wherever you go, who can help connect you with Spartans on the inside, who can help you grow in your career, people who give you special treatment just because you're a Spartan. And an investment in a life membership in the MSU Alumni Association doesn't just add value to your Spartan life. It helps Spartans everywhere build more competitive skill sets and move more quickly in the direction of their dreams. Learn more about an MSUAA life membership online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The Michigan State University Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.